Good afternoon, everyone.
I think I'll just sit for it, if that's okay. You can all hear me clearly, I hope. The question for today is, who are the Irish? In recent decades, the question of Irish identity on the island of Ireland and among the Irish diaspora has brought some unexpected answers. Different, more pluralist approaches to identity, as well as evidence from census returns and opinion polls, have created a radically new, very diverse picture of Irishness. The subject of Irish identity has long intrigued me at a personal and professional level. My father was born in Belfast in 1911 and educated at Trinity College Dublin. He was a wartime army chaplain and a veteran of D-Day 1. Most of his career was spent as a Church of Ireland clergyman in County Down in Belfast. He regarded himself as a loyal British subject and citizen, and also a proud Irishman. In the early 20th century, most Unionists North and South viewed themselves as Irish. This changed very considerably, as I have described in a chapter in my 1996 book, Dancing to History's Tune. In the 1990s, during my time as Director of the Institute of Irish Studies at Queen's, my interest expanded to identity among the Irish diaspora. Canadian historian Don Aikenson was a research fellow in the Institute during this decade, and we co-published his 1993 classic study of the Irish diaspora. In his writing, he insisted that when we talk of the Irish diaspora, we mean all those from Ireland, regardless of religion or politics. Around 1994, I was contacted by the office of President Mary Robinson in Dublin to arrange for her to give a key lecture on the Irish diaspora at Queen's. This came to nothing, and instead, she gave her groundbreaking speech on the Irish diaspora to both houses of the Irish Parliament in 1995. I was invited as a guest of the President to that occasion. At this event, she stressed not just the spread of Irish people throughout the world, but also the diversity of Ireland, which provided this flow, including not only Celts, but also descendants of English and Scottish settlers. She said, and I quote, "If we expect that the mirror held up to us by Irish communities abroad will show a single familiar identity or a pure strain of Irishness, we will be disappointed. We will overlook the fascinating diversity of culture and choice which looks back at us." And that's what she said. I was very honoured to be there, slightly embarrassing for me, because after she gave her speech, she then processed out of the chamber, and as she walked round with everyone, all the dignitaries following behind her, suddenly she stops where I'm sitting, and she speaks to me, and her procession stops, the whole Dáil stops, and everyone's looking at her, who is this fellow she's talking to? I was extremely embarrassed, and not clear what I said. Oh, great speech. Anyway, that was quite an occasion. So those two ideas, propounded by Aikenson and Mary Robinson, I think are very important in how we should approach the Irish diaspora. Let us then ask the question, who exactly are the Irish? The simple answer is that there are 6 million, that they are the 6 million who live on the island of Ireland, plus another estimated 70 million Irish worldwide, either born in Ireland or their descendants. When we look more closely, however, the subject is more complicated than this. Over the last half century, our knowledge and appreciation of the Irish has changed radically. We can look at the cases of the USA, Britain and Northern Ireland to illustrate this point. In America, 50 years ago, it was believed that around 12 to 15 million had Irish origins. Of those, most were reckoned to be descendants of Irish Catholic emigrants, especially the family emigrants, who were called Irish Americans. There was some awareness of earlier Protestant emigration from Ireland, especially by Ulster Presbyterians, whose forebears had been Scottish immigrants in Ireland, and many of whom were sometimes known as Scotch-Irish or Scots-Irish. It's the 18th century that these people primarily come to America. By the 1970s, however, there was little sign of their descendants. Then, in 1980, for the first time, the American census asked the question about ancestry. And to everyone's tremendous surprise, they reported a total of 40 million Irish. Completely blew everyone away. 40 million Irish. Now, of these, 10 million record a single Irish ancestry, while about 30 million declared Irish as part of a dual or multiple ancestry. At present, some 35 million claim Irish ancestry and another 4 million claim Scots-Irish ancestry. The second great surprise in this period rose from a number of opinion polls that studied the religion of different groups in America. They revealed that over half of those with Irish ancestry were Protestant or from a Protestant background. The 2006 NORC survey from the University of Chicago showed that of those who described themselves as Irish, 48% were Protestant, 29% Catholic, and 23% other or no religion. To explain the many millions of Protestant Irish, attention must focus on the first wave of mostly Protestant emigrants numbering over 200,000 who came in the 18th century to America, mainly from Ulster. Because of their early arrival and the multiplier factor, because they were there so early and due to a multiplier factor, there are now a very large number of their descendants, and a majority describe their ancestry as Irish and do not usually call themselves Irish American or Scots Irish for that matter. An example of someone with this background is former presidential candidate, the late John McCain. In the 18th century, his ancestor, Hugh Young, went from County Antrim to Virginia. As well, during the 19th century, many Irish Protestants from all over Ireland continued to emigrate. A good example is Barack Obama. His Church of Ireland ancestor, Fulmouth Kearney, left Moneygall in County Offaly in 1850. John Ford left on a famine ship from Cork in 1847. His wife died in the journey. You'd not have heard of him, but you'd heard of his grandson, Henry Ford, perhaps America's great industrialist. In 1917, he returns to Cork. Henry Ford does. He comes to Cork, sets up a tractor factory, and then he returns in the late 1920s to set up a car factory. So that's a second strand. A third strand are others with a Catholic background who became Protestant, such as Ronald Reagan, whose father was an Irish Catholic, but he was brought up in the faith of his Scottish Presbyterian mother. Vice President Mike Pence today is from a Catholic Irish American background, but he's now an evangelical Christian. So that's the case in America. The situation was more varied and diffuse than we could have imagined. Let's turn to what happened in Great Britain. The surprise happened another way around. In America, we're surprised at great numbers. In Great Britain, it's the opposite happens. Over the last two centuries, there has been extensive emigration of Irish people to Great Britain. In the late 1990s, it was reckoned that the number of those with Irish origins in Britain was the region of 12 million. In 2001, for the first time, the census gave people the option to register Irish as their ethnic identity. It turned out, however, that the number who chose an Irish ethnic identity was very low. The 2001 census reported that out of a population of 57 million, only 700,000, that's about 1%, of whom nearly three quarters were born in Ireland, recorded an Irish ethnic background. In 2011, in England and Wales, only 500,000 claimed such a background. On this occasion, most of those of Irish origins opted for English, Welsh, or British-only national identities. Various explanations have been given for the small numbers to record an Irish ethnic identity. A factor which affected people in their approach to this issue was undoubtedly the impact of Irish Republican bombing in Britain over the previous 30 years. Because of such violence, many with an Irish background chose to identify with Britain rather than Ireland. There are some other reasons, and I'll perhaps turn to those as well. The main reason, however, the main reason for the low number to declare an Irish ethnic identity is a high degree of integration of Irish-born people and their descendants into British society. By the end of the 20th century, many people with an Irish background, I should say most people with an Irish background, were fully involved and integrated and successful in the social, economic and political life of Britain. This success can be seen in the leadership of the British political system. When Prime Minister Tony Blair addressed the joint houses of the Oireachtas, the Irish Parliament, in Dublin in 1998, he stated, "Ireland is in my blood. My mother was born in the flat above her grandmother's hardware shop in the main street of Ballyshannon in Donegal." He also related how he returned in the 40s and 50s with the family to visit the family home in Donegal. They stayed at the Sands Hotel. John Major, the former Prime Minister, has recorded how one of his grandmothers, quote, married a young Irish girl, Sarah Ann Mara. Illiterate, my grandmother signed my father's birth certificate with an X, end of quote. Other politicians with an Irish background include Chris Patten, former Environment Secretary and Governor, the last Governor of Hong Kong, who has remarked on the irony of his role as the great-grandson of an Irish potato farmer in serving as the last Governor of the British Empire. While the number of those from an Irish background who decide to acclaim an Irish identity in the 2001 census was low, this is not to say that the many others who did not register felt no affinity with Ireland or had lost all their Irish identity. Under new circumstances, which have arisen from the peace process in Northern Ireland, more people in Britain are keener to reclaim an Irish identity, although not necessarily on their census returns as part of a minority. Marian Elliott has described how, in England, it is now fashionable to be Irish. Second and third generation Irish in their teens and 20s display none of the sensitivities of those in their 50s and older. End of quote. Brexit has caused some to reclaim their Irish links and look for Irish passports. In Northern Ireland, in recent years as well, there have been important changes in how people view Irish identity. In the late 1960s, before the outbreak of the Troubles, Richard Rose conducted a survey poll of Irish identities in Northern Ireland. He found that among Protestants, and you can assume most of these people were Unionist, 20% identified as Irish, 39% as British, 32% as Ulster, and 8% as other combinations. Among Catholics, the figures were 76% Irish, 15% British, 5% Ulster, and 4% other combinations. What it means is among the Unionist population, about 20% saw them as Irish. Among the Protestant population, among the Catholic population, about 20% saw themselves as British or Ulster. In 1971, Unionist politician Brian Faulkner wrote that, in the same way as Scots can be Scottish and British, quote, the Northern Ireland citizen is Irish and British. It is a question of complement, not of conflict. End of quote. In the course of the Troubles, however, with violence and stark polarisation over national identity, the number of Protestants who identified themselves as Irish declined dramatically. By 1989, an opinion poll showed the figure had fallen to 3%, as had the figure for those who choose an Ulster identity. That was now 10%, while 68% now describe themselves as British. Among Catholics, those who described themselves as Irish had declined to 60%, while the figures for a British identity had declined even more to 8%, and Ulster collapsed to 2%. Now, when you add up those figures, they don't quite add up, because there is another identity that has now come forward. At the same time, there is a support for a new Northern Irish identity. In 1989, 16% of Protestants and 25% of Catholics describe themselves as Northern Irish. I'll return to talk about that a little later. In 2011, for the first time, the UK census recorded national identity. It found that of the resident population of Northern Ireland, 40% described their national identity as British only. 25% described themselves as Irish only, and 21% as Northern Irish only, and 6% as British and Northern Irish only, and 8% as other identities. So just to repeat that, this is not quite a comparison with the earlier figures, this is just an overall figure. It found that 40% of the population described their national identity as British only, 25% as Irish only, and then 21% as Northern Irish only. The census also revealed that 94% of people with an Irish only national identity were or had been brought up as Catholics, while 81% of those with a British only national identity had been brought up as Protestants. Among those with a Northern Irish identity in 2011, 58% were from a Catholic background, while 36% were from a Protestant background. I might just say in passing, this 2011 census was very interesting because it did ask for national identity for the first time, and whereas in 2001 it simply asked for, you could say you were white British or some other ethnic minority. In 2011, it asked you have the option to declare your national identity as English, or Welsh, or Scottish, or British only. And the majority of people opted for English, Welsh, or Scottish only, while only a minority actually opted for British only, which is very interesting. The Northern Irish identity deserves further comment. For many Protestants, the term Northern Irish probably derives from the name Northern Ireland, part of the UK, and may well include some of those who earlier called themselves Irish. For many Catholics, the term is probably a northern variant of Irish, part of Ireland, so they're Northern Irish. At the same time, as John Gary and Kevin McNichol have recently observed, Northern Irishness does appear to be a real common in-group identity, inclusive of both Protestant and Catholics. End of quote. In my opinion, it can be seen as a form of Irish identity. The picture we have today of Irish identity as expressed in America, Britain and Northern Ireland is very different from half a century ago. This is partly because of ongoing changes, but also partly because of different approaches and new information. What we now see is no longer a single identity, but, as Mary Robinson suggested in her 1995 speech, a fascinating diversity of culture and choice. Thank you.
Brian, thanks so much for that really stimulating and interesting paper. Are you willing to take questions
from the audience?
Sorry, do you want, would people identify themselves?
Oh, yeah. Just finished it. Brian, the only Irish-born Prime Minister of the UK, Great Britain, Duke of Wellington.
Yeah, that's true, yes.
He had a famous quote about a Dublin Fusilier said to him, "You're one of ours," and he said, "If one's born in the stable, doesn't matter, an ass from there."
Yes, because I was born in a stable, it wouldn't make a horse. I think that's what he said. Yeah. But this apparently is completely
untrue.
It's recently
been denied.
It's especially been rejected. It was put up by O'Connell to denigrate the Duke of Wellington. Yeah. Completely false. So he is the only Irish-born Prime Minister of Great Britain. But it's often quoted.
Yes.
Sorry, man over here wants to ask a question. Yes, to go ahead.
My name is Fayaz. It occurs to me, having heard you, that Irish identity, that maintains a strong identity, can also contribute towards resolution of conflict, such as Northern Ireland troubles, because there was external intervention from the known Irish descendants in the USA. I mean, by the American president, Clinton, did he have Irish descent? Was he Irish?
So who's this?
Clinton.
Yes.
My understanding is that the northern conflict was resolved through American intervention only because there was an Irish element in that intervention.
Yes.
If that be so, if my assumption is so, that means if there were very strong Kashmiri today ruling somewhere in the world, perhaps India-Pakistan conflict may too have been.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't quite get your point.
He's just saying that was Clinton a key factor in resolving the
conflict? Yes, he was. And Clinton had an Irish link through his mother, who was a Cassidy. Cassidy originally come from Fermanagh. And he acknowledged that, but he was unable to work out exactly what the link was. But you're quite right, he did have that Irish link. And other people have that link as well. The case of Obama is very interesting. Because in his 1995 autobiography, he doesn't actually mention his Irish ancestors. He mentions, on his mother's side, Barack Obama mentions English and Scottish ancestors. He doesn't mention Irish. But other members of the family did know about it. In 2008, the first time he became Prime Minister, an Irish delegation went to him to congratulate him on his good fortune on St. Patrick's Day.
And
present him with a bowl of shamrock. And he said that he was very interested to learn that he had this Irish ancestry. And he said if only he'd known it earlier, when he was running for politics in Chicago, it might have been of great value to him.
Yeah, Neil, my name is Neil Kaplan Kelly. I'm a PhD student doing research here affiliated with QUB Irish Studies. I actually am distantly related to Obama from that shared Scotch-Irish.
Oh yeah.
So we should chat. But I wanted to follow up extend the question from there. I'm curious about the development of the Irish political lobby worldwide, and what the harnessing of Irish identity has done to promote not just the end of the Northern Irish conflict, but how that has developed to affect other parts of not just U.S. foreign policy, but policy here. And so what is it about Irishness that creates such a strong political lobby, in your opinion?
Well, the Irish-American lobby is a strong lobby. I mean, you have this strange situation that the Irish-American community stayed together in the way the Irish Protestant didn't. The Irish Protestant integrated, and in one way they did have a lot of influence in that a lot of the American presidents, like Jackson and all, have this Irish background. But on the other hand, because America was predominantly Protestant society and Catholics faced disadvantage and discrimination, therefore they kept it to their own communities. And in one way that gave them a strength, and that's why the Irish American lobby has been an important one. I think it's no longer quite so important, but certainly that was the case till recently.
Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah McQuaid. I'm a visiting research fellow here at Irish Studies. I found it really fascinating to see how you kind of can discover these groups in society through the mechanism of the census. But part of what you said also made it sound like that sometimes the options you have,
yes,
to identify yourself are sometimes exclusive, so they're British only, and sometimes they're not. And so,
yes.
Can you say more about how you read over the differences between
That is so important. Now, if you take the American case, okay. I said that in 1980 was the first time they asked an ancestry question, but the American census authorities had been very interested in this question for some time. And in their current population survey, which is a survey published every year, based on a very large national survey of about 100,000 people, they did ask the question, what is your ethnic identity? Mm-hmm. And they asked that from 1969. They asked you, identify yourself, what is your ethnic origin? See? This turned out to be most unsatisfactory. Mm-hmm. Because when they went back to people the next year, they'd have changed their mind. That was one thing. They found that people would say, well, I'm Irish, but I'm also Scottish. So they discarded that and put it under other. And then a lot of people just said, we're American. Mm-hmm. which was hopeless. The melting pot was working, but this didn't fit in with the question that people were trying to ask. So they then come up with a new question. And this is what the question was. They asked you in the 1980 census for your ancestry. And they say what that means. Ancestry, and in brackets, or origin or descent, close brackets, may be viewed as a nationality group, the lineage or the country in which the person or persons family were born in before arrival in the US. So they thought that would be a more definite thing. You see, something that everyone would have to answer that question. And then the second thing they did, which was critical, they said, we are going to accept dual identity. See? And remember I told you the figure's 40 million? 10 million Irish only, but the other 20 or 25 are other combinations. It's interesting what happens to the Scots-Irish. In the these national surveys, annual surveys in the 70s, a lot of people did return Scots-Irish. The figures don't show you that. Why? Well, they were just added into the English figures. The Scots and Welsh were just added into the English figures. And then when it comes to the 1980 census, 40 million Irish, not a mention of Scots-Irish. And why is that? Well, we now know about 4 million said Scots-Irish. And what then happened was, they thought that was a dual identity, you know, Scottish and Irish. So they're added into the Irish, and they're added into Scottish as well. They count them both in 1980. When it comes to 1990, however, then they do have a separate category. The poor old Scots, who in 1980 thought they had about 10 million people, 10 million of Scottish descent, that drops to 5. And the poor old Scottish Prime Minister, the last one, what's his name?
Salmon.
Salmon.
He's in trouble.
Went to America in the 1990s trying to recruit all these people with a Scottish. Would they not please say they're Scottish rather than Scots Irish? So that's one thing. So that shows you how that question. Now, when we come to Britain, it's the other way around. What happens in the year 2000 is you have an option. You can tick the box as British only, white British only, or an ethnic minority, in which there's a long list: Irish travellers, Pakistan, Indian, Irish. So only a small number, about 500,000, tick that box. So it's a lot to do with how this question is asked.
I'll come to you in a minute, Steve. There's a chap over here who's been trying to get in for ages, yeah?
Hi.
Is that you?
Yeah, I'm Richard O'Leary, a visiting research fellow in history. Moving away from the census to the issue of public debate about who are the Irish, and I'm thinking particularly of the attempts by the Ancient Order of Hibernians who organised the St. Patrick's Day parades to exclude the gay Irish.
Yes.
To what extent do you think that that debate engaged a wider Irish identifying population in America, and did it anyway change the perception of being Irish as being Catholic once eventually gays were accepted as being Irish in America in St. Patrick's Day parades?
But isn't the very latest on that they've withdrawn that ban now? Is that not correct? I think they have withdrawn that ban.
More than one city, and
yes.
Eventually,
well, I suppose these were just pretty conservative guys, and that's what they did. Yeah.
But did it have much publicity? Was it an issue outside the gay community in America?
I just don't know the answer to that question, I'm afraid. I just don't know.
Steve, you want to come in?
Hi, I'm Stephen McGill, a PhD student here at Queen's, looking at partition of Ireland and the perception across the dominions of the empire. So I'm very, very interested in this kind of question of identity. Just coming back into the earlier question, I was just find quite interesting that if you look at the origins of the Irish in, say, Canada and the Irish in America, you have a very similar kind of story. You have two very different conceptions of Irish identity, and how ultimately
yes.
in America you have this very strong Irish bloc.
Yes, yes.
In Canada you don't have that. I was wondering, how do you attribute and kind of reconcile two diasporas of a similar kind of timeline?
Well, Canada's very interesting because they reckon that of the immigrants who went there, it was about 50% Catholic, 50% Protestant. It was equally balanced. And they all retained their own identity in their own way. Now, in the case of the Protestants, the Orange Order was a big deal. I believe by the end of the 19th century, something like 1 in 4 Canadian white Protestants was a member of the Orange Order. It extended beyond the Irish. but they were a very strong bloc in a sense. I mean, I don't think they were an independent bloc. And then Irish Catholics also were an important group with their own organisations. But you certainly don't get the same Irish American, you don't get the same Catholic Irish identity as you do in Australia, in America. But the point is also brought out in New Zealand. You see, in Australia, Catholics were a majority of the emigrants there, and there was quite a strong Irish Catholic identity. That was less so among the Irish Catholics in New Zealand, partly because they were smaller in numbers, but partly because what I've read is that French religious orders were more important there than Irish Catholic clergy in their education, and that may have been a factor in affecting the way they looked at their Irishness.
So there's somebody here?
Martin Chong, I'm a visiting research fellow here in politics. Just now, first of all, you mentioned a statistic concerning those who identify themselves as Irish but without any religious identity. So I'm wondering whether you see any correlation between secularization and Irish identity in these different varieties.
Are you talking about America? Yes. Well, I mean, I gave the factors for America, something like 20% of people. Well, first of all, in America, a lot of people change their religion quite happily, in a way we don't hear so much. But also, there is a fair degree, I don't know, it's 20 or 30% are non-religious or alternative to Protestant and Catholic. I'm not sure how much it affects their identity. I don't know. I think in spite of secularization, they still retain a lot of their political identities. Can I mention the case of Barack Obama? This is a very interesting story. There is no such person has been located in an Irish record of his ancestor, Fullmouth Kearney. That name, it's a very unusual name, Fullmouth Kearney. And the only reason why it was worked out was done by a very clever genealogist in the sort of 6 months before he became president, did the work and then revealed it on St. Patrick's Day about 2007. And what she discovered was that Barack Obama's grandfather, as I've shown you in the poster I sent round, I showed you a photograph of him, and he was able to work out. This is the father of his mother. They're able to work out, I think Dunham was the name, Stanley Dunham, I think that was the name.
Yeah.
He was able to go right back to his great-grandmother, and she was a woman called Anne Kearney, and she was the daughter of a man called Fullmouth Kearney in the 1861 census for Ohio, okay? And it said he came from Ireland, but no indication of where, nothing at all. See? He was in Ohio. So she then searched the passenger lists coming over to America. And it was brilliant. He had this really weird name. No one else has ever been called Fullmouth in the world. This is wonderful when it came to tracking him down, you see. So it tracks down, in 1850, a man called Fullmouth Kearney, who's in a boat from England, actually. He's obviously crossed over to England and come back. And he's in the company of two other people, a married couple. And what he discovers is they're obviously travelling together, because in the 1850 census for New York, the three of them are staying in one house, okay? But when it comes to the 1860 census, 10 years later, they've moved to Ohio, and this young couple are now living with their parents, with her parents, and they are called Kearney. And it's quite clear, actually, she is a daughter of this elderly couple, Kearney, same as our friend Fullmouth. He's living in a separate house with his own family. But the question is, who are these people? And is there any connection with Fullmouth Kearney? Is there any connection with Ireland? And what they then discover is when this elderly gentleman called Kearney dies in 1863, his gravestone inscription reveals that he came from Moneygall in County Offaly, or Queen's County. You see, so that's the first clue. So they then go back, they then send researchers out to Moneygall. And I know the rector there who got this request from America to hunt out and see whether or not they had any mention of this Carney family, especially Fullmouth. Now, he told me that he often gets these requests and he just dismisses them because, you know, it's a lot of work. And however, he then got a second request saying, actually, this person may be an ancestor of the new president of America. So he said, well, good, I better start making it. So he looks up the books and he finds all the family there, the elderly couple, their daughter. He finds various people there and they're all baptized members of the Church of Ireland, baptized in the 1830s. This is a poor family, by the way. They're poor, they're shoemakers and the like. There's no mention of Fulmouth, by the way. But there is mention of a Timothy Carney. Okay? So this is evidence that these people called Carney did come from Moneygall. But the question is, where does Fulmouth fit into all of this? Well, the reckoning is that Fulmouth is Timothy. Now, how can you support such an argument? Well, when they then turn to look at Fulmouth Carney's family as recorded in the census for 1860, he names his 10 children. One of them is named after his wife's mother's name. The other is named after somebody else who we don't know. And all the rest are named after the Carney family. So the old gentleman and his wife, their names are used for the children. All the family from Ireland, the uncle who went to America 2 years earlier, one of the children was named after him. So all this chap Fulmouth Carney's children are all named after members of the family. So that's how the evidence fits together.
We still don't know why it's called Fulmouth, don't we?
No.
Very bizarre. Well, Brian, I think you
go
ahead.
One last small. I'm Nadia, I'm doing MA in Irish Studies. My question is about the Northern Irish identity that you were mentioning. What are your forecasts? What is going to happen to it? Is this here to stay, or it's like a moment in time, like Ulster identity?
Interesting question.
Big one.
Yeah, very big one. I think it's here to stay, actually. I think it's here to stay. It's a common identity, and people seem happy with it. But you're quite right to say these identities keep changing, and therefore you don't know what it'll be like in a short time. But I think it's here to stay.
All depends on Brexit.
Yeah.
Could Margaret tell us her answer to that question?
I don't know. Brian, I'd just like to thank you so much. This is a really stimulating, really interesting and enjoyable paper.
Thank you.
And we're going to have two parts to today because now we're going to have a launch and sell copies of Brian's book, Irish History Matters. Matters in both senses. Matters relating to Irish history, politics, identities and commemoration. And I've read it. It's a fantastic read. It's a really interesting book. It looks at commemoration. It looks at commemoration of the Siege of Derry, of Tone at Bodenstown. It looks at how the two world wars are commemorated at different times and how they change over time. Questions of Irish identity, which he's partly raised today, are looked at. Fulmouth Carney makes another appearance. And interestingly, he looks at the 1885 and 1886 general elections, milestone in Irish history, a period, I suppose, of democratisation and polarisation. So I think this book is both academically fascinating, but it will do what it's designed to do, and that is appeal to a wider audience, get people who think that academic history books are something they don't want to read one. And I'd like to congratulate you, Brian,
thank you, Margaret,
on this great book, and I'd like to urge you all to purchase a copy today at the greatly reduced price of £15 for a book like this. Is very considerable. And I would also like to welcome Brian's daughter, Catherine Walker, who is here assisting in the sale on this important occasion. So congratulations, Brian. It's a great honour. And I know you're also having a launch in the Royal Irish Academy
in Dublin
tomorrow night, where you are being launched by John Bowman.
That's correct, yes.
In prestigious company.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And you're sharing that launch with a reissue of a very important book.
Yes, it's Mary McNeill's biography of Mary Ann McCracken, published in the 1960s, and it's being relaunched tomorrow.
Mary Ann McCracken being the relative of the people I was speaking to you about today in relation to the Guy Viner book, so 1798, and Forgotten Memories, and a woman who was associated with Forgotten Memories.
Thank you, Margaret.
So, Brian, thanks so much. Now, you're allowed to say something
else. I'll just say a few words. I want to thank you all for coming here today, and thank you, Margaret, for chairing, and thank the Institute, thank Cathy for her help with the event. In my acknowledgement, I thank many people who have been very important for the writing of this book. I particularly acknowledge Don Aikinson, the great historian of the Irish diaspora, who's a senior research fellow at the Institute. He always encouraged my interdisciplinary interests, and I'm grateful for that. I dedicated the book to him. However, I have to point out an error in the acknowledgements, a very serious error. This is drawn to my attention by my wife and children, Catherine and David, who I mention in the last sentence of the acknowledgements. I thank them for their constant support, and also, what I say, their patient understanding of my state of distraction and absent-mindedness during the final stages of writing this book. They've taken great exception to the phrase final stages. I should have said for the last 4 years I've been distracted. Yes. So anyway, what does the title mean? It means two things. It deals with how ideas of history, perception of history, have been very influential. They've been part of the problem here. They've also, in a way, been part of the solution, part of the peace process, and that's valuable. History matters in another way in explaining where we are today, and I look at this in areas to do with politics, identities, and commemoration. Now, I had written a little bit more about how my interest developed from history to politics to comparative politics, but perhaps I'll not go into that. I just want to say a final word. I hope that if you read the book, you will find a positive picture about our history and our modern world. Today, relations between unionists and nationalists, between North and South, and between Ireland and the UK are very strained, due in large part, but not exclusively, to Brexit. However, we should remember where we have come from. Not very long ago, during our Troubles, relations were very much worse when we came through all this. At the heart of the conflict were serious divisions over nationalism and, to a lesser extent, over religion. At the same time, myths and perceptions of history were a part of the problem. Such views, as I point out in my book, came to be challenged and in the end to be changed. Various factors contributed to these changes, such as revisionism in Irish history, the exploration of different historical traditions by various groups, and a new approach to commemorations. Ideas of shared history were an important part of the new picture. This all helped to bring reconciliation between different groups and communities. So at this time of great tension, we should remember how far we've come, as I endeavour to show. I believe this gives hope for the future. Now let me illustrate this with three examples in my book to bring this out. One was in 2011, the Queen came to Dublin, a very important historic occasion, if I may call it that. She went to the Garden of Remembrance, which is in honour of those who died for Irish freedom. She then went to the National War Memorial for those who died in the First World War. This is very symbolic, and many people picked that up. People were looking at history as a way of cementing a new relationship. Then the second one was, there was a wonderful photograph in 2007 in the Irish Times. It was two people at a service. It was in the Catholic Cathedral in Galway to commemorate all those from Galway who died in the First World War. Now, there were two people standing there in the photograph. One was Eamon O'Keefe, and the other was Sir John Gorman. Now, who are these two individuals? Well, Eamon O'Keefe is a Fianna Fáil TD. He is a grandson of Eamon de Valera, who in 1916 occupied Boland's Mill in support of an Irish Republic. He later became Taoiseach and President. That's who Eamon O'Keefe is. But Sir John Gorman is probably not known to you. Sir John Gorman holds a military cross for bravery in Normandy. He was also an inspector, district inspector in the Royal Ulster Constabulary. He was a Unionist Member of Parliament. But he has another distinction. He's a son of Major Jack Gorman. I mentioned Eamon O'Keefe, his ancestor, connected in 1916. Major Jack Gorman was also connected. He was the last adjutant of the RIC barracks in Phoenix Park in 1922. And when the barracks was handed over on that occasion, he and a couple of his friends took their guns for their safety and they drove north in respect for the Crown, for loyalty to the Crown, and he joined the RUC. So here were ancestors from totally different political backgrounds, but here they were standing together on this event to remember those who died in the First World War. Now the third event involves my good friend Margaret, because Margaret and I were at a wonderful conference in Ballyshannon on the 10th of November, and on the way back we passed through Enniskillen on the 11th of November, which is Armistice Day. See? I might say Armistice Day, especially in Enniskillen. Enniskillen was the first place in the whole United Kingdom to mark the ending of the war in 1918 on the 11th of November, because a smart, alert telephonist at 6:30 in the morning of the 11th of November picked up a message from Marshal Foch to all his troops at the front line, his commander, saying the war will end at 11 o'clock today. So they get the rector out of his bed and they ring the bells. And the church bells rang in Enniskillen 2 hours before they rang in London to end the war. Anyway, Margaret and I were there on the 11th, and we went to the cenotaph. And at that occasion, there were Heather Humphreys, Irish government minister, laid one wreath. Arlene Foster, the DUP leader, laid another wreath.
But they were really commemorating the bombing, weren't they?
Commemorating both those who died in the war and also those who died in the Enniskillen bomb of about 2 decades ago. And what impressed me was that in the parade then that took place at the cathedral afterwards, there were members of the Royal British Legion, these ex-British Army people, but so also were ex-Irish Army people. A large contingent of ex-Irish Army soldiers marching through Enniskillen wearing the blue berets in honour of that occasion. So this to me shows how dramatically things have changed, and that's why, although things are a bit rough at the moment, I still remain very hopeful. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. So I urge you all to buy copies of the book, Catherine.